I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Welcome to our Countercurrents Book Club. Once a month, we do a book club where we feature a book published by Countercurrents or any allied publisher. Basically, we just want to have an opportunity for authors and readers to have a conversation about books, to help people dig more deeply into books and ideas, and we hope sell a few copies and educate people, educate, enlighten, entertain. So I thought we would have my book, my latest book, Against Imperialism, featured today, because I'm trying to sell that, trying to move that out there, trying to influence people's thinking, trying to get people to actually read it. And I thought that we would have on two guests who I think have interesting takes on all the issues in that book. And I would really like to hear these guys' responses. I want to know what they think is strongest and weakest about it. I want to prove my arguments. So I want to bring in first Matt Parrott. Matt, welcome to the show.
Glad to be back. Thanks for having me, Greg. Always a pleasure.
And I'd also like to introduce our friend Pax Populi, also known as Angelo Plume. Angelo, welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me on. Looking forward to this conversation. Very interesting topic. So I can't wait to get started.
Well, great. Matt has won the coin toss to go first. So Matt, do you want to begin?
When I saw you'd published a book against imperialism, that piqued my interest. I try to keep my addiction to nationalist books to a minimum. I couldn't resist on this case. I went ahead and purchased a copy and enjoyed it over the last couple of weeks, actually. And when you had invited me to speak about it, I was really looking forward to speaking about it. But I was kind of curious, you know, what compelled you to actually, because I know you've kind of, a lot of your posts recently, a lot both on social media and on Countercurrents have kind of circled around this. I was kind of wondering what inspired you to go ahead and just turn it all into an actual book.
And that's a good question. I was looking back at the stuff that I've written about these issues, going back 10 years now. And back in 2014, I believe, I was starting to write about this. And 2014, 2015. And you can see a kind of evolution in my thinking going on around that time. I started realizing that Americans have a somewhat skewed perspective on ethno-nationalism, ethnic politics, white nationalism, and that when you talk to European nationalists, you start confronting certain limitations in our own outlook. And specifically, you know, I was talking to some Polish nationalists in 2014, and they said, well, you know, our number one problem isn't immigration, it's emigration. This is 10 years ago. And our relationship with our neighbors is fraught by battles that we've had, ethnic cleansing, and also Polish minorities in neighboring countries, and the pressure that they often face to basically abandon their identity and learn a different language and basically call themselves Lithuanian or Ukrainian or whatever. And I started thinking, well, this is interesting. There's a whole raft of problems that we face because of this. And we have analogous problems in America. But Americans tend to be naive about that. There was also talk of Brexit coming up. There was talk of Scottish independence. And I got people in the Anglosphere in America signaling about, oh, these are the evils of petty nationalism. We want all Europeans to be in one grand state, you know, from Galway or Iceland to the Urals or Vladivostok. Well, why not throw in North America too? That kind of stuff. And I thought, well, if countries like Poland are challenged and other countries in Europe are challenged by the fact that they have poorly drawn borders that don't map off out on ethnicities, if there's a minority problem in Europe, if European confederations, artificial states like Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia have broken up peacefully or through wars. It just seems kind of daft and vapid and very American to say, well, we just need to put everyone together under one form of government. Isn't that the another form of the diversity that we bemoan? Just a whiter form of diversity. And so I started criticizing those memes and reading more about it. And I, over the years, built up a sort of backlog of stuff. I published some of these articles in other anthologies. But it really all came to bear. It really, all of this memeing for empire really came out again after the beginning of the Ukraine war. And there was a point at which I started to suspect that people who were talking this way, this was back in 2015, 2014, 2015, really were just engaged in sort of pro-Russian metapolitics. This was after the Maidan. This was when the seizure of Crimea took place, and then these breakaway republics in the east of Ukraine. This was back in 2013, 2014. And I saw this empire discourse being used not as some kind of grand vision for the future, but as a basically as an ideological tool for rationalizing some actually pretty grubby and selfish and petty, dare I say, petty imperialism. So anyway, and all of this came back. They really cashed in on this, the Russians did. They really cashed in on the groundwork that they had prepared after the beginning of the Ukraine war. So I revisited these issues, and I revisited the theoretical issue of Imperium, and I also revisited the Ukraine-Russia situation. I had a couple of debates on it. There were questions that arose connected with concepts like sovereignty, and I really enjoyed these conversations. I thought they were generally pretty good. There was one debate I had with E. Michael Jones. It was a bit of a farce. I did a debate on Ukraine with Mark Collett that I thought went a lot better. And so I included a lot of that material in there, and that's sort of the core of the book. That's the first half of it. And then, like a lot of my anthologies, I also include more topical commentary on the stuff that was going on, as long as it has some kind of value, you know, as long as it doesn't look like it's going to go too stale anytime soon, as long as it's got some general principles that you can draw from that will be relevant in a few years down the road. I really learned a lesson with my book, Toward a New Nationalism, because there was a whole bunch of stuff in there that years later just seemed like ancient history. And so when I brought out the new edition, I just dropped a lot of that stuff. And so in the future, I'm going to try and not anthologize things that I think will go stale. And so that's basically how the book came about. It was basically gathered together a lot of arguments that I had formulated in 2013, 2014, 2015 about ethno-nationalism versus imperialism, and also about Russia-Ukraine relations. This was all galvanized by the return of these debates after the Ukraine war began. And so that's what got the first half of the book to gel. And I think the most important stuff. And then the rest of it is stuff that I still want people to read that's got some good ideas in it, but is not in you know properly related to imperialism, theoretical or practical imperialism. So that's basically how this project came about.
Well, while reading it, especially for the first part, I kind of wondered halfway through, like, is this against imperialism or against Russia? But I mean, the argument has to be kind of presented through the prism of our current conflicts, right? And I do think, for better or worse, the Ukraine conflict is the perfect platform on which to unravel and expose and elaborate on a lot of these ideas that have kind of been bubbling around in the dissident right for decades now, where people can have pretty much polar opposite views of the future and yet see themselves as kind of on the same page. And there's nothing wrong with that in some sense, in that, you know, if you're a white advocate, then that's fantastic. And if we have some, you know, some fork in the road a century from now, we can, you know, take that fork in the road then. I don't, you know, want to, unnecessarily pick any fights we don't need to be picking. But at the same time, the imperialism versus nationalism question kind of was forced by this conflict, because it does kind of makes you pick sides and it colors the prism from which you perceive the conflict.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted you to talk about this. I wanted to get your perspective on this, because you have been very consistent in especially in recent years, in taking an anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist, anti-supremacist model of basically advocacy for our people, but it extended to other people as well. You're a universal nationalist. I'm a universal nationalist. And so I thought that I would like to have your takes on this. You were also involved with the Trad Worker Project, which was very pro-Russian and Orthodox even. And so I thought that you would have maybe a kind of stereoscopic vision on the project that I'm setting out here. So that's definitely one reason I wanted to. And also just because we haven't had you on in a while, and I just thought it's a good time to get back into a real conversation with Matt, not just these online back and forth things on Twitter, which has been a lot of fun recently.
Yeah, I love nothing more than arguing on social media. I feel like I should stop, but that'll probably be the only lasting impact I make on the world is my silly arguments on social media. So I don't know where to, you know.
Well, a lot of things you say on social media have changed people's minds, and you know, it's like the butterfly effect, right? We're not flapping our wings, we're flapping our gums on social media. And, you know, somewhere across the world, 30 years from now, a government may change because, you know, we flapped our gums on social media. That's how metapolitics works, to put it in a somewhat cartoonish way, but that's how it works.
I've seen that butterfly effect thing play out too many times, where something you said gets echoed in some way, in some context, so much greater than the original. You know, you just really have to trust ideas to release them into the wild. And sometimes you'll be amazed by how, you know, the places they'll go, right?
Yeah. One thing that I absolutely love is it's been 20 years, I think, since Mike Polignano published his little article on his blog. He had a blog before blogging was cool, published an article called Taking Our Own Side. Now everybody uses that term to describe what we're about. We're taking our own side on this issue.
A couple things there. With Trad Worker, it wasn't so much pro-Russia as it was at that time, as you'll be the first to agree, because you were watching this. Agents of Russia, people who are, and at the time, I didn't really understand it in a context that only kind of blossomed later, were pushing what my opponents might call petty nationalism, right? As sort of a weapon against Western imperialism. The canonical example being kind of like with Hungary and some of these examples where Russia was supporting ethnic identity. And I think there was a very limited, I think it gets exaggerated in hindsight, but there was a kind of limited amount of interaction with white identity. It never went very far, and it couldn't go very far, because the Russian sort of Soviet boomer mind imagines themselves as the ultimate anti-racist and imagines, you know, white America as the cesspit of racists who were just terrible to black people. Their intelligence apparatus was never going to actually be supportive in any meaningful way. But there were, like, a Dugin spoke at a by satellite or not satellite by internet spoke at a conference that we had been in attendance, and we had had some superficial contact with Dugin and some others. But I wouldn't necessarily frame myself as pro-Russian. I think especially with the Orthodoxy, like people don't give me enough credit for being autistic, as far as that really is the theology of Orthodoxy. And I regard myself as Western Orthodox. And mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, the best way to describe it is, you know, Orthodoxy can just be the Western Protestant experience done correctly, done theologically consistently, without seeing it as a branch or a tentacle of the Kremlin or whatever. As a lot of people, I understand where people would get that impression when they see the Orthodoxy, and then they saw Dugin, and then they saw, I think it paints a simpler picture, sort of my faith experience and the politics at the time. But if you'll recall, I think it was back in like 2013 or something, I was actually very critical of Dugin, and I published it at Countercurrents when I had read The Fourth Political Theory.
Yeah, you were somewhat scathing about that, actually, as I recall. He's sort of all over the place. Is he a social constructionist? Is he a feminist? He's all things to all people.
Well, and that's the thing with Dugin. I'm not positive about Dugin. How can you even be positive or negative about Duginism, given that an ism has to have, like, there has to be something there to ism, right? There has to be an ideological foundation. And it's essentially just a Soviet and pre-Soviet revanchism that's all over the map. 10 years ago, the Chinese were an evil menace who were a threat to the great Russian world empire state or whatever. And now that's, of course, totally reversed. And China's our biggest, best buddies ever. And we're going to have a Sino-Russian, front against the evil West.
You've always been allied with Asia.
Big 1984 vibes with some of that. No, I certainly would not. I think of myself as kind of the first anti-Duginist in the West.
You were anti-Dugin before that was cool.
Yes.
Yeah. So let's bring Pox in here. Pox, do you have any questions or thoughts about the book so far? What are your impressions?
Well, I find this topic really interesting, and it was very serendipitous how our paths intertwined, because about exactly a year ago, this topic had become the main theme of several of my Telegram live streams that I used to do to a very small audience of followers, and some of my posts on Telegram as well were about this, because I just really value genuine diversity, particularly in Europe. And there is a lot of, I value genuine diversity, and I'm wary of this arc, this pull towards ever more centralization of power, globalization, which in my opinion is ultimately Americanization. Everyone is kind of watching the same Netflix programs, listening to the same American rap music, eating at the same American fast food restaurants, and wearing the same kind of American clothes all over the West in particular, but also at a grander scale, even around the world. And I like different languages, and I traveled around a bit, and I feel like I was lucky enough to have done it, just like the millennials were lucky enough to be born right before everything became digital and online. Millennials were just born on that cusp where they still got to use landline phones and learn how to use a map, and I had to do things the analog way. I had this lucky moment where I could still go places and see for myself the genuine expressions of ancient cultures, local cultures, listen to dialects being spoken, things like this, but at the same time see that it was being eroded and replaced by what we would now call global homo, perhaps, and diversity. Saw a lot of that creeping in. And I don't really like it. I think it's very boring and bland and bleak. And so around the same time as the Ukraine war promoted this, this question became a lot more pertinent about superstates, global hegemons versus smaller states, independence movements like in Catalonia or Scotland or Wales, Northern Italy. And I fall on the side of, and also just taking my own ideas to their logical conclusions and being consistent. I support, ethno-nationalism. I support people having the ability to live according to their customs and in honor of their heritage and pursuing their own destiny. And around about the same time, you wrote an essay against imperialism. And I read the whole thing on a live stream. and that was, I think that was pretty much the start of our working relationship.
Yeah. I knew about you before that. I knew about you through Nick Gilvey having you on his streams. I had seen parts of a couple of your talks, and so you were a known figure. But just to be perfectly frank, human egotism being what it is, nothing recommends somebody like somebody who likes your work and practically reads the entire essay out and comments on it on his live stream. And I said, but the thing that was, I really liked your take on it. I liked how I thought it was really intelligent. And I said, okay, I need to reach out to this guy. And so that's exactly how we started interacting and working together. And it's been a little more than a year. Has it been just a little more than a year?
Yeah, this was in January of 2023 that I did that stream on your essay. So it's been just
It was December of 2022 that I published it. Yeah.
Yeah. So now I'm not too much of a theory cell, as that term has become known. I try to stay practical and pragmatic. Occasionally, it's good to have intellectual exercises and talk about hypothetical situations. So I don't tend to spend too much time on this subject, even though I do find it interesting. So the questions I have would be more about the practicalities of it all. And this sort of cuts both ways. I think there are practical obstacles that both the ethno-nationalist or nation-state side has to address, and also the superstate or the imperialist side would have to address as well. So one of those cuts would be, what's more likely for us now? And what's better for us now? Because in my opinion, we're kind of on our knees and someone is standing behind us with a gun pointed at the back of our head. Is that really the condition for creating a white imperium at the moment? And is that really what we should be working towards when we're in such a vulnerable position? And as you mentioned in your book, the last thing the European race needs is a conflict amongst itself and the creation of a dominant hegemon, an imperial ruler, would inevitably cause a conflict amongst ourselves. So that's something that the imperialist side need to keep in mind. On the other hand, how likely is it that we're going to have ethnostates anytime soon? And recently I had the task of going through the Countercurrents archives and doing some changes here and there. And all the way back to like the year 2010, the year of Countercurrents founding, you had this conversation going on in the community, in the movement of nationalists all over the world. Guillaume Fay was a part of this, a principal player in this, about Euro-Siberia and things like this. I don't know if that rings any bells for you. It's 14 years ago. I think this kind of has simmered down, the idea of creating a Euro-Siberia. So we've been having this conversation for quite some time, and things are moving slowly, but in what direction are they moving? And in what direction should they be moving? So I'd like to hear your thoughts, Greg, on that.
Well, I think I really address that in the piece I did with Greg Hood, the debate I did in Greg Hood, the opening statement, one white state or many. And the argument that I make is it's very practice centered. I point out that there are 52 historically white states in the world today, meaning nations that had that were normatively white and had a substantial white majority, before the age of mass migration started, and that's could be any time between the 50s and 60s, right? It's literally as many states as in a deck of cards, right? And leaving out the Vatican, because that doesn't really reproduce or anything, that's just a sovereign head of a church, but it is still historically white. All of those states have demographic crises now. They all have some serious common problems. White demographic decline, open borders to one degree or another. And therefore, if things don't change down the road, basically after a long decline, white extinction. And the death or the mutilation to the point that it's unrecognizable to us of all the things that we love. Everything that we love will disappear when white people disappear. And that's the path we're on. Now, what I would like to do in the current circumstances is rally white people. And I want to rally white people everywhere there are white people, and especially in historically white states, some of which are de facto or normative ethno-states already. But even if they're multi-ethnic, you know, quasi-empires like Spain and France and the United Kingdom, I want to rally people in all of those existing jurisdictions, and I want to rally them to contest state power wherever they are, and try to change the policies that have been implemented in all of these jurisdictions to cause declining birth rates, below replacement fertility, open borders, just anti-white culture, anti-white hate spewing from every authoritative institution of society. That's where we can stop these things. Because there are people who are very, very cynical, and the imperialists, they're very cynical about sovereignty. Nobody has sovereignty, except maybe the United States, right? That kind of stuff. Well, fact is that if you control a nation state, you are empowered to say no to other nation states. Might be costly, might be dangerous, but you are empowered to do that under international law. The smallest state and the biggest state in the world are treated as equals. And you've got the power to say no. And yet you also have the power to say no to any smaller jurisdiction inside you. So you can't just have a neighborhood or a province or something deciding we're going to control our own borders. We see what Texas is trying to do, and the stuff they get from the feds about that, or Arizona's tried this. You have to control the state, whatever kind of state it is, right? And so what I would like to see are grassroots pro-white movements everywhere there are white people moving to contest state power, to take state power, to socially engineer — it's a dirty word for libtards and libertarians — socially engineer our way out of this crisis, because we were socially engineered into this crisis. And the only way to reverse that is to change institutions and incentives that have been put in place. So from a very pragmatic, practical point of view, I think ethno-nationalism, or just sort of civic nationalism, right? In the sense that you would have civic nationalism in a country like France, patriotism, the forces of the right, because it's the people who are going to take up this banner tend to be people on the right. As much as we have interesting stories about former Bernie bros who have come over to our side, and they do exist, most of the people who are going to respond to us are objectively on the right. They're going to be patriots of whatever kind of state they're in. We want to get these people mobilized to take state power and change things. And so basically ethno-nationalism and sort of quasi-ethno-nationalism, like you would have in France, for instance, are kind of baked into our project. If we start where we are, if there are people who are listening to me in France and or Moldova or wherever, and they start where they are and they want to wake people up, they're going to speak the language of Moldova or France. They're going to relate to people of the same ethnic group, in the same language. They're going to reference the local laws, as well as things going on abroad. They are going to seek power through the local power structure. So it's inevitably going to be touched, tainted, if you will, from the imperialist point of view, by petty things. Petty things like the fact that they speak French in France, as well as other languages and dialects. These are all little petty facts that cannot be waved away or dismissed. And if you mobilize people to save whites, wherever whites are, that means you're not saving generic whites, because there are no generic whites. You're saving Americans or Canadians or Frenchmen or Wallonians and so forth. And so I think that just from a pragmatic point of view, that's how we win. That's how we start. That's where we start. And it's a big mistake for people to basically pour cold water on that and say, well, this is all petty and this is naive. Don't you know that you have no real sovereignty? Don't you know, you French nationalists, that you have no real sovereignty? And basically the battle has to be won in the United States. I mean, that's the message that they take from this. And they roll their eyes and they think, these deracinated Americans, they're so full of themselves. And I don't want to be the ugly American. And of course, there are Frenchmen like Guillaume Fay who believed in this idea too. But most people in Europe sort of look at this as an American idea because they think Americans are just some hideously deracinated Europeans. They don't think of us as a people. And they think that we want to assimilate everything. We want the whole white world to speak English. I've met white nationalists who want that. I remember when Richard Spencer was exuberance. I remember that. He was exuberantly talking about how a homogeneous European man is emerging. And we need an ethnostate. Just in the singular for the homogeneous European man. That just sounds like crazy American talk in Europe. And when I started coming to Europe and actually networking with European nationalists, I didn't want to come off as the ugly American. I wanted to listen. I came to Europe to learn and listen because their movements were more advanced than what we had in the United States. And so I kind of canned it with the ugly Americanisms and listened. And I became sympathetic to basically starting where people are and encouraging them to fight where they are. Because I think that basically because white people are divided up into these different states, that we will save white people one state at a time. Now, some states are more consequential than others, of course. I that would be foolish to deny. Some states are more powerful than others. It's obviously true. If things come down to war, that matters more than it does in international relations, where there is this idea of the comity of nations, the equality of different nations in the comity of nations under international law. That those are real concepts, and those are honored. They're honored verbally always, even if they're being undermined and practiced. So you have to use the norms that people pay lip service to, if not actively believe, and we can do that. But if things come down to war, yes, some states are more consequential. I think France, if France goes nationalist, if France goes racial nationalist and starts sending them all back, France can't be treated like Serbia was in the 90s. France is a major nation with an independent nuclear arsenal. They can't be Serbia'd. They can't be treated like Austria was when they put Jörg Haider and the Freedom Party in power. And so some countries are more consequential than others, but I think that we need to fight everywhere that we are. And I the messaging of the imperialists basically says, you guys in these little European comic opera states, as Yaki called them, you can just sit this one out. The big battle is going to be for Washington, D.C. I just say no. I want more people fighting on our side, fewer people fighting against us. And I want people working this problem and trying to gain power in whatever sovereign state that they happen to find themselves. That's how we begin. That's how we move forward. And that's how we're going to start winning.
A good point you make in the book, too, is that wars and other crises, but particularly war, are temporary situations. And you shouldn't base your entire vision on temporary situations.
Well, one of the arguments that's made for Imperium, right, is, and this comes from people who like to play strategy games. I know people. I know and love people who like to play strategy games. I'm not dissing them. But they're always war games. They're never peace games. Peace games aren't any fun, right? And you learn, well, the bigger battalions you have, the more territory you have, the more men under your command, the more formidable you are. And whites are facing formidable enemies from other civilizational blocks. So shouldn't we all pull together in one big white state and unify? Doesn't there come strength through unity? Shouldn't we want that? Shouldn't that make us strong? And the response that I make to that is twofold. Basically, it's not necessary. We don't need one white state for white people to ally together in times of common crises. We can have things like the things that we have today, like NATO, treaty organizations, military alliances, things like that, which do not require that you surrender your sovereignty. We can have those things. And then the other thing is, if you're really concerned about avoiding war and conflict, well, what about avoiding war and conflict between white people? And one of the ways of avoiding war and conflict between white people is to give them their own spaces where they can chart their own courses, control their own destiny, speak their own languages, and not have to ask anybody's permission to be themselves. We've seen the breakup of the Soviet Empire, of the USSR. We've seen the breakup of Yugoslavia. We've seen another example, a much more happy example, of the separation of the Czechs and the Slovaks. That's the direction I'd like to see things move, not towards super states that basically abrogate the sovereignty of the constituent states. That's what the EU is trying to become. They're trying to become a sovereign super state with their own military, things like that, at the expense of the freedom and sovereignty and diversity of the constituent states. That's a bad thing. And it will cause conflict and war. And so the creating a big white imperium is not the way of avoiding the next brother's war. It's the way of starting the next brother's war. And it's not necessary to win the next world war. God forbid that one should break out. But if one should break out, it's not necessary to win that. All we need is something like NATO to basically coordinate between white states and a federation of, or a military alliance, let's call it a military alliance, because those are temporary things, quasi-permanent things like NATO. Basically, you keep the channels open, right? So you can come together quickly. A military alliance just of European states would be sufficiently powerful to defeat any force on Earth. I'm completely convinced of that. So it's just not necessary. War is a terrible thing, but to win the next global war, we don't need a sovereign superstate. And to avoid the next brother's war, we shouldn't try and create a sovereign superstate.
Well, I'm kind of with the imperialists in a sense, in that I do think, like, when it comes to the scale of power, it's not so much which side would you prefer, but which side is sort of geologistically necessary. The difference between me and imperialists is I'm completely on the opposite side of that. I kind of regret, I wish we had somebody who is pro-imperialism to beat up on here rather than just sort of, I'm going to strawman them to a certain degree. But during the Charlottesville trial, I kind of had a unique opportunity where Richard Spencer was trapped in a conference room with me against his will for several days, right, while the jury was trying to deliberate. And I wanted to try to get from him how all the global megatrends aren't devolving and devolutionary in terms of how we had the nuclear age in the 20th century. I think so much of everything we talk about is the conversation is still in the 20th century, whether it's calling ourselves according to groups that haven't existed in 50 or 80 years or whatever. We haven't made that leap psychologically to the new millennium and looked at where trends are actually at right now. I think we're no longer in the nuclear age, but the Napster age, where the locus of authority and sovereignty, it used to be necessary to be sort of a transcontinental superstate in order to acquire all the resources, infrastructure, talent, and everything necessary to have a nuclear bomb and therefore achieve geopolitical sovereignty. And that's largely given way to where you have all of these smaller state and even non-state actors are achieving all kinds of new agility. I'm not just talking about it in necessarily military, but even in political context that would be unimaginable a few decades ago. And I see the American empire as weakening with the smaller states and groups within it, including ourselves, white Americans or European states, having more latitude than they had 20, 50 years ago. And I see Russia facing a similar crisis. I see both of the empires as sort of fighting these devolutionary trends that, in my opinion, strongly favor us as long as we're not becoming sort of revanchist, trying to restore an order that was deeply hostile and destructive towards us, right? The idea that we would want to be imperialist when the logic of imperium is necessarily blending identities together and downgrading the importance of ethnic, racial, social, and every other thing in service of this imperial machine, right? Why would you be in favor of that, and how would it serve our interests, both either racially, ethnically, or personally? I didn't feel like I got a satisfactory answer. I can only go so far in characterizing an argument that wasn't recorded, and I'm the only witness speaking about it. But I feel like I didn't get a satisfactory answer to that. It's just sort of these imperialists, the ones I have spoken to, all seem to have this idea that obviously history, as it moves forward, always gets more centralized, and that's not my analysis of history at all. You had the Roman Empire, and then you had other periods during the Middle Ages with like the Holy Roman Empire and stuff, which where you had these tiny little statelets with a tremendous amount of power, autonomy, sovereignty, and ability to define themselves. I see technological progress being profoundly devolutionary ever since the advent of the internet, and it's only becoming more so, and that snowball is only growing. And I feel like we need to get out in front of it in order to achieve the wins that are available from this paradigm shift.
I agree with that. Look at the changes since 1989. There are more sovereign states in the world today than there were in 1989. In 1989, we saw the beginning of the end of communism. We saw Yugoslavia break up. We saw Czechoslovakia break up. We saw the Soviet Union break up into, 13 different independent states. And there were certainly more that wanted to be independent, like the Chechens, for instance. This, if you wanted to speak grandly about the arc of history in the past more than 30 years, 35 years now, has been going towards more states that are smaller in size. That's just the trend. And yeah, there are certain technological things that are making that more and more possible. And I think the internet is making that more possible. It's certainly breaking down the ability of small centralized elites to coordinate everything from a central source. We're not sitting in our living rooms listening to two news broadcasts from three networks anymore, like we were in the United States when I was a kid, right? Or you were a kid. You remember that too.
Oh, yeah.
You remember the centralized control. You remember the three networks. You remember the Associated Press. You remember the few big press organs that were basically putting out a unified message to everyone. That has been breaking down for 25 years now or more. And I think that if the powers that were then were as far-sighted and clever as a lot of the conspiracy types give them credit for, they would have strangled it in its crib. They would have seen this is the beginning of the end for us. But, you know, they're short-sighted and greedy and foolish too. And they let this genie out, and this genie is going to kill them. And right now, I think our elites are related to the internet in the same way that heroin addicts are related to the heroin, right? They're addicted to it. And on some level, they know it's going to kill them, but they can't quit it. They can't imagine life without it, even though the greater information freedom that we have and greater information decentralization that we have will kill these centralized establishments. If they don't stop it, I don't see how they can stop it at this point because they're so intertwined with it. It's that one ring thing. They can't throw it away. They can't throw away the ring of power, or they can't throw away the
well. They logistically can't. I mean, the public key encryption algorithm is such that your toaster has enough processing power to securely send messages, and communication is power.
Yeah.
And, you know, the most obvious example of that is Bitcoin, where you build this trillions of dollars in wealth on just communicating these micro contracts, right? And it's math, and you can't, you know, they're succumbing to the contradictions at the late mercantile age contradictions within their own system, and it's slowly cannibalizing them, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with that. The trouble with the imperialists is, it's not just imperialists, but it's statists in general. And I'm a statist. I believe that we need state power. And I believe that it's perfectly all right for the state to use force to make people's lives better and make people stop doing destructive things to one another. Totally down with that. I used to be a libertarian. I never thought in a million years that I would be saying such things when I was like 20, but here I am saying this stuff. I'm a statist. That said, the people in our sphere who praise the big state or the strong government or whatever, they're always imagining that they're going to be controlling it. And I just think that that's kind of a goofy, LARPing attitude. I want a big, strong, centralized state when it's our state. And a big, strong, centralized state that's their state is a profound threat. So I'm not pro-state. If somebody were attacking the state today, I'm going to get out of their way, right? I'm not going to repeat things that I think are false, like libertarian talking points. There's no point in that. I believe in cleaving to the truth. But I'm certainly not going to get in the way of people who are taking down the current state system. And I do imagine that a lot of people who want to build these leviathans or want to feed these leviathans. And you, if you look at somebody like Spencer, and I don't follow him on Twitter, I guess the only thing he does now is tweet. But occasionally I'll see him quote tweeted or something. People will send this to me and say, "Have you seen this?" And it's like, oh God. You know, I mean, Spencer is actually protective of the modern Leviathan state now. He imagines this is his pet in some way. He's always imagined that he was part of the establishment. It was one of the dumbest, LARPiest, goofiest things about him. I mean, his whole conduct at that trial was premised on the idea that he thinks he's part of the establishment. It was the same folly that David Irving was in the grip of when he said, "Oh, I don't want a jury trial. I want a trial with a judge, a bench trial." Why? Well, he believed that, you know, this would be an educated Englishman and like him and a part of the, it's complete madness. But but a lot of the people in our sphere, and I don't want to just pick on Spencer, they foolishly imagine that they will be controlling these things. And I don't think that that's a wise assumption at this point. That said, we do need to fight for state power, but until I've seen this argument more recently. I had an exchange on Twitter when I was talking about what I would like to see devolution, breakups. I'd like to see secession in America. I'd like to see ethnic secession in places in Europe. And this guy said, do you want to break up America into a bunch of impotent little statelets? And I said, yeah, I do. And the reason why he didn't like the idea of breaking up America into a bunch of impotent little statelets is that he, on some level, identified with the present American regime. And so he felt that if that regime is diminished, he's somehow diminished. And I think that's a totally wrong way of looking at this. I think that diminishing the current regime empowers us. Yeah, Angelo, do you want to jump in here?
Yeah, so much to say in response. So much has been said. I'm just trying to make sure I retain everything, remember everything. I do find it funny that on almost every occasion, almost, it's Americans who seem to fall on the side of Imperium. I wonder, I have my own suspicions as to why that is, but I just think it's funny because if you think about the origins of the United States, they started off as, you know, many nations within a territory. And
for against brief, an empire.
And against, you know, empire. And for a brief time, they were independent colonies. I mean, why is it called the United States? Because they had to unite. Because until that unification, it was very similar to, you know, what you might see in a place like Spain or Italy with all these different regions who are fiercely proud of their regional or even provincial identity well before they even think of themselves on a national identity. And so, you know, there was Virginians. And there was people from Maryland, and that was their location. That was their roots and their what they identified as. And so I think it's funny that there's so many Americans who have just forgotten about that ethos of their origin, and now like to or would prefer to cling on to what America is now, which is sort of like an empire. I suppose that's just the way that the wheel of time turns. I'm sure that someone living at, you know, middle to late stage Rome would have had romantic thoughts about maintaining the empire and would not really be thinking much about what Rome used to be when it was just a little city, a little tribe out there in the Italian peninsula. Some other thoughts. Another criticism, I suppose, another challenge to ethno-nationalists. This is one that I hear on many occasions. Is that empire, Imperium, has a grand vision. It's epic. It's inspiring. You referenced, Greg, in your book, you know, it inspires images, thoughts of Warhammer 40,000 and, you know, Rome and Napoleon and things like that. And ethno-nationalism is what? Petty, small-minded, you know, just I just want to be left alone type thing. And that's not going to happen. They're not going to leave you alone. But my thought has always been, given the conditions of now, not the conditions of a fantasy world, in reality, what could be grander than breaking away from this globalization and breaking away from an international regime that is quite dead set on eliminating us and eroding us and wiping out our heritage even, and certainly wiping out our future, breaking away from all of that and forging something new that is yours also, that you made it, you and your kin and kith have created something. You've broken away from this, as you put it, a Leviathan that's devouring everything. And now you're going to pursue your own destiny. You and your people are going to pursue your destiny the way you see fit. I think that's rather grand, actually, and just at least if not more grand, at least as grand as ideas of, you know, empire and a super state or a civilizational state.
I agree. Yeah. And it's also more achievable. And it's something that can motivate everybody. Because, yeah, I don't want to pick on small countries. In fact, I love small countries. I want more small countries to come into existence.
They're you know, better functionally as well. Like if you read, you know, Leopold Kohr, or even going back thousands of years, this was being debated by Greek philosophers like Aristotle, the ideal size and scale of a society. Even all the way back then, it was pretty much agreed that the best way to have a functioning society is to keep it at a manageable size of population and scale. And I, you know, ask yourself, where would you rather live? Switzerland or India? You know? Right. And yeah, I just think, and also as we were talking about tonight with, you know, the future of warfare and things, because this is something that everyone from Elon Musk to more liberal-minded people, left-wing-minded people like Matthew Iglesias, to this sect, this cult that worships elite human capital, they all believe that the future depends on nation-states. If you want to have power, if you want to have influence, nation-states have to cram as many people as possible onto the landmass, not leave one blade of green grass untouched, build everything on top of it. You know, oh, you like this nice vista, the plains of Montana? No, we're going to build a bunch of ugly new houses and apartment blocks and fill them with Hondurans.
Okay, we need 1 billion Americans so we can finally be a great nation. Actually, America would be a greater nation if we sloughed off 150 million people.
Yeah.
Honestly, I find it so funny. We'd even be stronger.
I find it so funny when Americans are so resistant to this. I think also because perhaps Americans, because America has maintained the same constitution for over 200 years with a few amendments here and there, because it's always been a democratic republic. You know, European countries have gone through monarchies and dictatorships and republics and then doing it all over again, the same cycle. You know, countries like France change their constitution, what, every Wednesday? And so there maybe is a little bit of a lack of imagination, but I would implore Americans to understand that empires, if empire is inevitable, if a hegemon is inevitable, what is also inevitable is that the empire eventually collapses and crumbles. And whenever that happens, what's left of the empire becomes small nation states, or the nations that were under the empire arise as new independent nations who can now pursue their own destinies. And for me, looking as an outside observer now, I'm not in the United States, but looking at what's going on to white people there and how precarious their situation is, you just don't see any better way for the salvation of white Americans than to start having breakups and to be able to do your own Aranya in Texas, in Idaho, in Oklahoma or something, you know, wherever. And, you know, given the freedoms that Americans always boast about having, should be easy on paper, at least on the sacred paper of the Constitution, to do so. But a lot of Americans want the imperium for some reason. They think that's, you know, that's power and that's the future. And you have this sect that thinks, no, we need more. We need, and I just find this so anti-American, actually.
Well, you know, it is.
Filling forests and building and just filling it with brown bodies. And in a future that's going to be ever more automated, AI, robotic. This is why even is a billion man army, is it really that terrifying when we can wage war with cyber attacks and drones and things like that? So I'll just leave it there.
Well, I just want to add real quick, it is a fundamentally anti-American vision, and it goes against the founding theme of America, this idea of empire. And you know, one of the things that kills me about American-Chinese relations is we actually had like a good, warm vision of ourselves with the average Chinese person, with, you know, the Chinese elite as sort of the anti-imperial exception among the Western powers, as the one who had generally tried to be fair-minded and anti-imperial and less colonial than the other Western powers. And that's that's definitely not been the case recently, though. I would wish to note that I think there's an imbalanced perception among Europeans, because the people who go to Europe or make an active effort to politically network in Europe are naturally going to be ones with kind of a global imperial vision. I do think, generally speaking, the America First air quote petty nationalist vision does have more grassroots support and is the stronger faction in America, though I think a lot of Europeans end up seeing our ass end and seeing the ugliest Americans in this conversation.
Yeah. Guys, I would like to pause for a minute and look at some of the comments and questions and donations that have come in. If you would like to donate, folks, if you have a super chat that you'd like to send our way, those always get priority because we do like to use these streams for fundraising as well. It helps us pay our bills, helps us stay strong. Go to entropystream.live/countercurrents without the hyphen. It's across the bottom of the screen now. Hit the green button. You can take out your credit card and you can send a donation that way. We used to have a Cash App thing, but they recently deplatformed us, reminding us that yes, deplatforming is still a thing. Recently, David Cole was bounced off of Twitter, the new free speech Twitter platform. So censorship and deplatforming are still real. They've lightened up a bit, thank goodness, but they're still threats. And you can help us out, though, by going through Entropy. Entropy has stood by us. It was 2019 that we last had a credit card processor. It's 5 years now. We have gone for 5 years without a credit card processor. And we're still here and bigger than ever, right? But it's been hard. It makes it difficult. Entropy is now the only way that you can use a credit card to send us money, or you can send us tips through Odyssey. So do that as well. And let me just read through some of the things here and thank people, and then we'll go back into the book. So Gandalf the Grey says it comes off as very strange and non-American, as a non-American hearing Spencer's rhetoric. Tom writes in, I've never voiced this thought to anyone, but I believe there's a strong probability that the white world will be saved by our cousins who are sojourning in another continent, North America. Maybe the white American will be the modern world what the Greek was to the ancient world. I implore my European brothers not to hope that we're going to ride to their rescue. I think Europe would be better off if America turned inward because it has basically a breakdown. That's the only thing that's going to get America to turn inward. I think Europe would be better off without America. European elites and European middle classes and midwits, everything that's bad in Europe, the middle classes, the midwits, the elites, they're all imitating America. It's creepy how on so many levels in Europe, and Angelo can confirm this, as an American, it's creepy how much cred we have, even on an unconscious level. You know, there are a few countries where people look at America and they'll openly say, like Orban Viktor in Hungary, America is obviously not the model for the future. But shockingly large numbers of Europeans basically believe that, even if they won't articulate it that way. So Gandalf writes in, I'll just say as a Canadian, though, I'm totally fine if you guys annex us. I don't like that idea. The North American Anschluss. Yeah, I've heard that. I used to say shit like that. This was even before I was a white nationalist. And I have a Canadian side of my family, so it would almost be like getting together with the family. But still, Canadians and Americans are actually two different people. Anglo-Canadians and Anglo-Americans are different people. They seem very similar, especially if you're not one or the other, but they're still different. And of course, there's the Quebec question. My Canadian mother, who, you know, had a green card in her purse, always said about Quebec that if they let the Anglo-Canadians vote on Quebec independence, it would have sailed right through, right? Okay. So Dr. Martin Luther says, this would be meaningless unless North America goes pro-white, meaning Anglo-Canadian Anschluss, American-Canadian Anschluss. Gandalf writes in, oh, you've never played as France in Civ 6, taking the world over with loyalty. Okay, that's cool. Reed Johnson writes in, there's winning the war, and then there's winning the peace. Martin Luther writes in, reading Countercurrents and Greg Johnson made me a smarter and more articulate white nationalist. Thank you. That's basically what I've been trying to do for the last 14 years of my life. Green Party says Greg's sounding a bit like Wilmot Robertson circa 1972 right now. Well, that's good, except for the Nordicism. I never liked Wilmot's Nordicist prejudices. Even Sam Dixon, who's a great fan of Wilmot Robertson, I remember asking him on a live stream what he got wrong, and he said, "I wish he hadn't been so mean to the Italians." Anyway, yeah. Gandalf the Grey writes in, ideally, yes, we don't fight each other. Going by history, we will always fight, though. We just have to save ourselves before brother wars won't kill us. Martin Luther wants the Richard Spencer jokes to flow. He says Matt Parrott doesn't read books. He stares them down until he gets the information he wants. That's actually quite clever. Let's see. Tom says, imagine a million motivated and disciplined white identitarians securing our future, not at the expense of any other race, would be a foregone conclusion. Absolutely. I like to put it, imagine a million Matt Parrots or a million Gadius Maximuses. I would not fear for the future. Archie says, cyberstates may be forming. Martin Luther wants to say more about Richard Spencer. And like Martin Luther, our Martin Luther isn't mealy-mouthed in the least. Gandalf says empires evidently collapse. Okay, we got a $10 donation from Gadius. That was on a tear on X this morning, posting about libtards. I feel as though I was cooking there for a minute. Yes, you were. I enjoyed that. Anyways, I feel like imperialism could be inherently libtarded, as it seems related to abusive spouse syndrome. Good talk, gents. Any thoughts on that? Did you guys see the back and forth on X today about... Gadius basically says, I'm not going to embrace Hillary Clinton in the Western, in the white ethno state just because she's a fellow white person. Basically,
I saw he was quoting a lot of his tweet. It just kind of went on for a long time, and I got lost in all the quotes. So I was scrolling through some of it, and then I was like, I think I just need to have been there in the moment that he was cooking. but yeah, I saw some of what he was saying, and you know, I think the catalyst for it all was Black Pigeon.
Oh,
his Twitter alias made a post saying, "Which kind of American are you?" And it was like grade A. You've been here since the Mayflower, and then ascending up to grade, or descending if you prefer, to grade B and grade C and grade D, with the last grade being like Ellis Island Americans and, you know, border jumping Venezuelan American. And I think that was what made Gadius start this sort of thread that went into, you know, a lot of the grade A Americans who can trace their ancestry to the Mayflower are all up there in the Northeast in these nice little neighborhoods, and they're libtards. So who's better? You know, because then you've got the Americans who might be grade B or grade C living in the Midwest, you know, came a little bit later, and they're more patriotic and they're more conservative, if that's a good thing in your opinion. I'm not quite sure about that, but it's an interesting point. But yeah, I did read a little bit of Gaddis's thoughts on that. I thought it was pretty interesting.
Yeah. Among the best people in the white nationalist American scene are, and I say this as an old stock American, pretty old stock. On my father's side, the family arrived here in 1618, okay, before the first Black person. And on my mother's side of the family, well, they arrived in North America in the 19th century. So grade A and what, grade B or whatever, ancestry. But honestly, the WASPs gave it all away for the most part. And in the context of our movement, it's a lot of the kinds of people that my WASP family would have looked down, the kinds of people that H.P. Lovecraft, you know, would, you know, liken to some kind of subhuman, you know, bubbling spawn or slime, you know, the Ellis Island Americans. A lot of the Ellis Island Americans are more based and race realist than the grade A Americans. So honestly, a lot of the grade A Americans don't have a future They're the ones who were raising their hands and taking a knee and stuff like that and behaving like absolute sheep for the slaughter in 2020, for instance, after BLM went crazy again. So, yeah, the thing that the comment that I made in this debate was simply that libtards and Americans proper are becoming two different nations. And libtards are embracing aliens, they're embracing basically their own extinction in some kind of fit of moralistic pique. And they're openly contemptuous of real Americans, and they openly want to basically replace us with foreigners, disenfranchise us in the meantime. And we can't live with these people. They might be our kith and kin. They might be first or second cousins. They might be members of our own families. But if they get their way, we cease to exist as a people, and we have to separate. And if there's a white American ethnostate, which is basically a redundant term in my view, if there's an American ethnostate, the replacists, the white replacists, they will go with their pets. We won't even have to force them to. They'll immediately line up with the people that we want to separate from. And I think that's a healthy thing.
You know, it might be difficult to accept, but we do live in an age where ideology reigns supreme. And
yeah,
that's a reason why, particularly in the American context, when you think about like where would Civil War 2.0 be? Where would the lines be drawn? Because it's not as simple as, you know, the way it was in the 1800s, North versus South. The questions are more complicated. And like Gaddis was saying, you know, I'm not going to accept a Hillary Clinton just because she's white like I am in the ethnostate. No, we have to have people who are on the same page, have the same vision, have the same values. And that, I think, I might be wrong on this, but I think that kind of thing, you know, ideology, your worldview, your values, all of that matters a lot more today, I think, than it did in other times in the past where things were a bit simpler, maybe. And it was just, look, my tribe, good. That's not to say that people in the past were simple. I don't believe that at all. But conflicts or the lines that were drawn in conflicts were a bit simpler. You know, if you were a member of the noble warrior class, I fight battles because I want glory and the wealth that comes with winning. And my lord wants a new castle. Okay, so we're going to go fight and take a castle. Whereas nowadays, it's a lot more ideological.
Yeah, and I do think that ideologies are a force that tends towards ethnogenesis, if you will. For instance, what is the difference between the Serbian and the Croatian nations? Well, honestly, they're genetically very, very similar to one another. What differentiates them at a certain point was ideology. And the ideology was basically, what brand of Christianity does the state embrace? Is it Catholic or is it Orthodox? What, you know, they have the same basic language, but one used to write it in Cyrillic and the other in the Roman alphabet. So what you have is you have two peoples that are very similar genetically, very similar linguistically, if not having the same language. Basically, I mean, they're dialects and things like that, but you can say that Serbo-Croatian is basically one language. If German is one language, then Serbo-Croatian is one language. Okay. And yet they're two different nations and they don't want to share the same government. And they've got lots of built up reasons for that, which they remember very well. And okay, fine. That's an example of how ideology can be a form, the thing around which a new ethnic group crystallizes, a new nation crystallizes. I think that's a process that's going on in North America today. There were people that were Americans, and now they're basically separating into two different nations that are at war with one another. And there's a cold civil war. And it's too crude to talk about red and blue state divisions. Although if you look on the county level, the red and blue counties, that's a more fine grain thing. But still, I mean, it's not just area. It's the differences of ideology express themselves in who, you know, wins elections in those areas, but they're fundamentally very different. They're becoming different peoples.
You're achieving the epistemic divorce. You're achieving, including a lot of like actual relocation.
Which yeah.
Is, there's a slow and steady, but it's building kind of reshuffling where more, I call them contards versus libtards. Both are offensive, but that's just the terms I use. You know, these contards who live like in New York City or New Jersey or whatever are starting to kind of move into red states. And you have people yeah. in the red states who are like, I can't take this anymore. I've got to move to a blue state. And over time that's crystallizing. I mean, you know, aside from common heritage, common inheritance, you know, what else is a nation? And in my opinion, it's, you know, it's not only people who get the same jokes, but also have the same truth. I mean, you have things like 1 + 1 = 2, and everybody can be forced to agree on that or whatever. But so much like, you know, watching the Democrats and Republicans of now, and Greg, you're old enough too to remember how politics was in the 90s. It was one nation of people who had these disagreements about how we were going to move forward. And now that vibe is totally gone, right? It's how are we going to get the other side? It's gone so us and them.
They hate us. And they hate us and we hate them. Let's just be frank. Much of politics today is just taking positions to spite and own the other side. It's totally unhealthy.
Yeah,
we need a divorce.
Has he been indicted, you know, 109 times and is a terrible criminal who shouldn't even be allowed to run for office? Or is Trump a hero of America who's being persecuted by an evil regime that's unfairly indicting him on all these false charges? Which side do you believe is the truth? And I think with Spencer and a lot of these, you know, Hanania and the others they're people who dabbled in the race and identity stuff, but at the end of the day realized that they really are loyal to the libtard camp. They are cosmopolitan, they're urbanite, and the nature of ethnogenesis is tugging people out of the movement, or you could argue tugging the movement apart. Though I haven't seen any evidence of any real development of any actual white identitarian thing on the libtard side. You see these intellectual things like with Hanania or Spencer and others, but you don't actually see it developing the same way you do on the red side of that divide, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, let's scroll through a few more. We have some really nice comments. We have a nice, cozy, happy crew of people here. So I'm enjoying the vibe. Dr. Luther writes in, Greg Johnson and Matt Parrott, two white nationalists I profoundly respect. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Somebody respects
you. Yeah. Gandalf the Gray, he says, I'm listening to a podcast of three guys from their man caves. This is magic. Thank you very much. Archie says, good reasons for slavery. I'm not getting the context there. Sorry. And Gandalf says, embrace the anti-libertarianism. Dr. Luther wants to say more about Richard. Gandalf says, Spencer, in a kind of joking way, compared himself to Hitler. His ego gets in the way. Green Party says, Spencer will be appointed to the second Biden administration. Just you wait and see. Now, there'll be a bidding war between the second Biden administration and MSNBC.
Yeah.
Double O Sieben, they don't want to be even more at the mercy of places like China. I think that's in response to small nations, or is it, maybe it's response to Russia. Tom says, what do people think the international chessboard would look like without the USA as hegemon? Well, let's talk about that for a sec. Just in the short term, in the short run, if the United States takes a big dive, and I think it will, and it probably will in the near future, what's going to happen? Well, we've already seen signs of what happens when the United States gets weak. We had the Afghanistan debacle. And then immediately after that, as a basically a crime of opportunity, we had the beginning of the the Ukraine war, which is the worst war in Europe since the Second World War. When the global hegemon starts wavering, people start settling old scores. There will be many, many wars happening. When basically Russia was distracted with Ukraine, what happened in the Caucasus? Azerbaijan and Armenia went to war. Now Armenians have been ethnically cleansed from an area that they've lived in for thousands of years. More of this will happen. More of this will happen. And eventually things will settle down. And I hope that once they settle down, the United States will not be the net negative that it is. Because even by keeping the peace, even while keeping certain elements of peace, and that is true, it is promoting the decline of Europe, the destruction of European man. Now, if America retires and stops exerting influence on Europe, that doesn't mean that things will get immediately better in Europe. Not at all. Just like things didn't get better in Europe after Brexit, in the UK after Brexit. Why? Because the UK was run by its own bunch of globalists. And they just reduplicated all the bad stuff that was coming out of Brussels in
traitors,
London.
Traitors, even. Traitors. Traitors.
Yeah, absolute scum. So, but here's the thing. If the United States isn't exercising its immense influence in Europe, that means that the subaltern nationalist forces that have been kept down for 70 years, basically, will be able to assert themselves. The libtard establishment in most of these countries will become weaker, and sensible nationalist alternatives will become stronger. And one by one, we can hope that these countries start changing their policies. Now, there'll be many ways that it'll happen. Some will just have outright rightist governments. Others will do things like the Social Democrats did in Denmark and just say, screw it, we don't believe in immigration anymore on left-wing grounds. These things can happen. It'll happen in different ways, but Europe, which is the part of the world that I'm most concerned about because it's the cradle of our race and civilization, I think Europe will eventually be better off if the United States isn't basically goading it down the road to extinction. But after the United States loses its influence in Europe, it still has people who are imitating it, and those people need to be removed from positions of power. But it'll be easier than it is now. So that's my short version. Matt, do you have any thoughts about what the world would be like without the USA as a hegemon?
You know, it's that fascinating alt history. I think the rapprochement between Russia and China is largely driven by a common competitive threat from American hegemony. And if America weren't there, those two would not be moving closer together as they're doing. I think in a lot of ways, America is already further along in the decline of global hegemony than people realize. I think a lot of times when you predict the future, you pause for a minute and then you realize, no, that's already further along than you realize. I think as far as Europe, you would see Germany nationally reviving itself in a way it hasn't been able to under the aegis of Anglo-American imperium. I think you could see another like war between France, Germany, or England or whatever that hasn't been possible because of the unfair balance that America brings to the table. I don't know. I mean, there would be positives and negatives with that, and I would like to see all of these imperial hegemonies kind of decline at the same pace together rather than envision one collapsing before the others, because then you would end up with power vacuums and, like you say, old tensions and stuff filling into those vacuums. No, I wouldn't. I see that as a pretty kind of scary future even for Europe.
Angelo, what are your thoughts?
Well, as the resident anti-American, I think that an America that has sort of left the stage, it's no longer the most important piece on the chessboard. I think that is going to be rather positive, actually. But there's two things to keep in mind. The first one, talking just about geopolitical power and influence, I think what the future would look like with America no longer being the hegemon is that basically we'd have a world where things like what happened between Azerbaijan and Armenia will be more commonplace. And that is to say, regional conflicts will flare up from time to time, and they will be resolved by the people, the groups in conflict. And there won't be red, white, and blue going in and getting involved. Now, that's perhaps neither positive nor negative. It's just neutral. But sometimes the way to peace is through a fight. And, you know, for the Armenians, that situation ended poorly for them. But the conflict was brief and it sorted itself out. And it did not escalate and did not threaten to provoke a worldwide conflict. Perhaps because there's nothing there that is of terrible interest to many of the people who pull the strings of power in Washington, perhaps. So I think that would be one way that the world would look like. A challenge to you, perhaps, Greg, is that, and this is something that people on the pro-imperium side often repeat, is that, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. And if America is not the hegemon, someone else will be. So it might as well be us. And that's, I think, another reason why Americans like to cling on to the quote-unquote empire that they live in, or that that has been built, because they would rather the hegemon be America in perpetuity instead of it becoming Russia or China or BRICS or things like that. I actually think that the future might be one quite similar to the multipolar world, where there'll be several competing hegemons. But then there's also something to keep in mind, and that is America's mediatic power. And I don't think that's going away anytime soon at all. Even if America became a less than important geopolitical force or military force, even if regional conflicts in, you know, various corners of the world were just left to play out by themselves and America's not getting involved, therefore NATO's not getting involved, America's allies are not being dragged into it. Okay, that's, I think, a positive change. Maybe European countries will re-understand the importance of having their own military sufficiency, and they will get back to business of rearming themselves and not depending on, you know, Sky Daddy America to watch over them. Those are positive developments. But all that aside, America will kind of rule through its media influence for a lot longer. And this is something that ethno-nationalists need to keep in mind. It's all well and good to have an independence movement or referendum break away from, you know, institutions like the EU or the United Nations, or break away from the United Kingdom or the nation state of Spain, if you're Basque or Catalan, what have you. But you have to deal with the realities of the world. What are you going to do about American social media apps? What are you going to do about Hollywood films in your new country? What are you going to do about the ways in which someone can take over your country without firing a shot, but simply through the means of media and propaganda and subversion and all these kind of things? I think no matter what happens to America's geopolitical influence, its media influence will be enormous for decades and decades and decades.
I think an analogy here that might be useful, even though it's slightly ridiculous, would be Hellenism, likening American popular culture to Hellenism, Hellenic culture in the ancient world, is ridiculous. But isn't it fascinating how after Alexander spread Hellenic culture all over the world, and then you had these successor Hellenic states, and Rome basically was Hellenized. It was the source of a common culture and literature for the ancient pagan world. And it even outlasted, and this is the disturbing thing, it even outlasted Rome. Eventually the Romans spoke Greek. and we're centered in closer to Greece and in Byzantium. That's kind of a fascinating thought.
Maybe the pendulum of American power will swing back to Britain.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting thought too. Well, there is something very powerful about the Anglosphere. There's no question about it. But yeah, it might be the case that Europe will, first of all, I think the future is going to be multipolarity. It already is multipolar. We live in a multipolar world. So the idea that the multipolar world won't emerge if we don't give Russia her way in everything is just a silly idea that people like Dugin promote, right? There is already a multipolar world. It's a robust multipolar world. I would like to see a multipolar world where basically the Europe is united and is reasonably independent of the United States in a political sense. And I would hope so in a cultural sense too. But you know, English is going to still be the lingua franca in Europe, ironically. Maybe they'll start speaking it with more of a British accent. I don't know. It is interesting generationally, if you look at Anglophone people in the continent, you find older people will speak English with a slightly British accent, and practically everybody under 60 now will speak English with an American accent.
Oh, yeah. As an English teacher, I have so much I could say on that.
Yeah. And yeah, so that will probably be around, but honestly, it's more important for me just to get the political independence first from Washington. And yeah, maybe America, and honestly, that means American Jews, will enjoy a huge amount of highly corrosive soft power even after the American hegemon has fallen, after the hard power falls. I would hope, though, that as Europe changes and as European states become run by European identitarians, that what they would start doing is promoting their own native culture, and not just high culture. They're actually pretty good at keeping that going, but their own popular culture that's healthier.
Yes.
I think that can be done. And if the United States can ban TikTok, then I don't see why European countries can't ban certain social media apps that are run by hostile people.
So I've been branded anti-American on many occasions. I've had various spats with Americans in this quote-unquote movement or adjacent to it, because I say harsh criticism. I don't pull any punches with regards to America and Americans even. And I'm speaking to two of them right now, so I hope that's also a demonstration that I consider Americans friends as well, but I have criticisms to make. And one thing that I warned about a ways back, especially when the Russian and Ukrainian conflict was really kicking off and people were kind of feeling perhaps that they were forced to pick a side, and it was leading to all sorts of rather existential questions, certainly ideological questions. So one thing I warned about was that this kind of friction is going to flare up more and more, especially as things get more and more serious. And I really do think that Europeans and Americans need to have a very serious and honest conversation. And people like Academic Agent have stirred this pot, but with very frustrating results. It's very disappointing to see, particularly the reaction that he gets from Americans. Because he'll say objectively true criticisms. He'll point out things. He'll go back into history. He'll have the receipts. And Americans will just kind of cope and seethe about it. You know, things about how America has kept Europe down. America has subverted Europe. America has poisoned our very concept of what is a nation, with, you know, birthright citizenship and anchor babies and things like that. And not just since 1965, but even going back to early days, you can see the roots, you can see the seeds of these, what I would call rather bad ideas, or ideas that have had bad consequences. And as you said, Greg, Europe is the mother. Europe is where we all come from. And there might be trouble in the in the countries where the European diaspora has gone and the countries that they created. But a lot of people who live in these countries created by the European diaspora have a homeland that they could go back to in Europe, like me, for example. That's what I did. Maybe not a lot of people can do this politically. If you don't have passports or you can't, you know, prove your lineage or whatever, it can be a lengthy process. But the point is, we have somewhere to go. So if Europe falls, we don't have anywhere to go. I frankly think that America is worse off than Europe in many important ways. It's not a place that I would flee to if I was looking for a safe haven. So there's going to be friction if we want what's good for Europe, because often what's good for Europe means that it's not going to be good for America, or at least it's not going to be good for American power. And Americans need to understand that. And I would like Americans to be on the side of Europeans and saying, look, yeah, we agree. Our ruling class, the American regime, is corrupt and abusive and malicious. And we will join you in taking it on. We'll join you in doing what we can to stick a finger in the eye. But I feel like a lot of Americans don't take that path. And they would rather say something more like, you won't survive without us. You know, you're being anti-American. They kind of use the word anti-American, much like the Jews use the word anti-Semitism, to just quash any criticism, and even no matter how valid it is. And so I think this is a really serious issue that Europeans and Americans need to realize. What are we fighting for? What do we hold dear? And what's the best way to move towards a future that's good for us? And I really do think that that future means Americans, you know, what's the unwritten slogan of NATO? Keep America in, keep Russia out, and keep Germany down.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Like, that just needs to be completely abolished. And I don't care if that's going to make life for Americans a bit unpleasant or they won't be as powerful anymore. Well, sorry. I'd rather have a world where Germany is actually stable and exists, and it's the German homeland and they have a future.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that all European nations can be stable, live at peace with one another, and have a future, have futures as themselves. And yeah, I think that America has to take America has to change radically, whether that means it collapses or whether that means it gets a better government. We'll leave that open. As an American, piety demands that I hope the best for my country, right? Plan B, though, is that America fails and that Europe survives. And that's more important because Europe is the motherland for me, for all of us, whether we appreciate it or not. We have a few more questions here. Folks, we're coming to the end. We got about 15 minutes left. So let me zip through a few questions and comments here and thank people. And then I want you guys to tell me where I need to improve my argument.
Before we change the subject, yeah. Could I go ahead?
Yeah.
Maybe this is I'm hoping this is constructive criticism, but if you would frame your arguments, I see this out of Europeans quite a bit. If you would frame your arguments in terms of opposition to the American regime or the American elites, I think you would sidestep the national pride of Americans and actually find popular support among Americans with whom the general sentiment, especially on the right, is opposition to the regime. I mean, you know, the Republican Party, the general voice on the ground is, let's get out of NATO entirely and let Europe be independent from us. Let's stop that. America first is the, it doesn't mean America before every other country. It means Americans focusing on their own country. So I think if one would just say I'm against the American imperial project instead of I'm sick and tired of Americans doing this and that, it would transform the nature of the conversation quite a bit and be far more effective. It's kind of like when people complain about Polish plumbers or whatever. you're trying to make this argument against this immigration crisis, and then suddenly you're kind of implicitly insulting all Polish people, and you can't even have the original argument because mm-hmm. then it's about whether or not Polish people are all stupid plumbers. That's my thought on that.
Yeah, I think that's well said. I can think of a lot of cases, especially with French nationalists, where they have really led with the ugly American jokes. and even I would get, I would bristle at that. I felt patriotic about that. And I have to calm down and, you know, understand, yes, they've been colonized with Le Big Mac and all that. Anyway, let's look at a few more comments and questions here. David Zuddy writes in, a lot of the Imperium argument comes from Yaki, which is ironic. Yaki foot stomps how facts are more important than how people think things should be, but the current facts lean toward pluralism as being more mm-hmm. practical. I agree. That's where the arc of history is pointed. ABC writes in with $10. Thank you. Neighborhood wealth, not urbanicity or population density, predicts pro-sociality towards strangers and other races and cultures. The suicidal altruistic behavior of the white race is correlated with average wealth. What other solutions than war or hardship are available? I mean, this is a really big and interesting question, or can be a big and interesting question. I think there's a common root between prosperous white people and prosperous white nations and openness to strangers that's now becoming suicidal. I think that it's the same ethos, that white societies are not clannish. We're more individualistic. Well, what does that mean? It means that we're more open to strangers, means that we're more capable of we're always taking the risk of lowering our shields and reaching out our hands in friendship to more and more people. And that is some deeply evolved pattern of behavior. It gives us dopamine hits, makes us feel noble and big, but it's also been rewarded when the people that we lower our guards to and open our hands to are basically like us. And what it's allowed is for whites to create huge, prosperous, what we'd like to say, high trust societies. And I think the most highly functional and prosperous whites do that. They're pro-social. They work well in groups. They're constantly looking to enlarge their team, add talent to the talent pool, stuff like that. And it's only become pathological in the last two generations because the borders have been open. It's been pathological for a lot longer than that, when we allowed basically Jews into our country because they have a dual ethical code. They demand openness and a fair shake from us. And they practice nepotism amongst themselves. And it's a parasitic strategy that allowed them to become enormously popular and powerful, not popular, but enormously powerful and rich. And then when they had sufficient wealth and power, they opened the countries to all of these kinds of tribes. And now we're just beset by them on all sides. So it is a weakness when we encounter groups that don't function by the same basically code of individualism and openness. So what are the solutions? Well, we have to rein ourselves in, basically. And we have to distrust our moralism. We have to distrust the feelings of being big. We have to realize that this isn't working for us anymore. And in fact, this is now a suicidal strategy. Whereas in fact, for thousands of years, it was an incredibly powerful survival strategy that made us very, very wealthy and made our societies magnets for the kinds of people who want to cheat us, hack us, and take us over. So those are my thoughts on that. We have a couple other questions. I don't want to run out of time. Green Party sends $5, maybe a bit off topic. What are your thoughts on VDare apparently shutting down due to lawfare by a black female Soros DA? It is true they are shutting down because of lawfare from a black female Soros DA. I think it's a terrible thing. I think it's absolutely terrible. And they're going to be missed. And I hope that they continue to fight the battle that they've been fighting in other ways. Also, I hope the writers who have been writing for them, you know, they don't disappear, that they continue fighting. I hope the donors that have been giving to them don't start donating to libtards and MAGA or contards, but they keep the money in the fight. It's a defeat, but it's only a major defeat if all the parties that are under the VDARE umbrella today, which is merely a brand, it's been around for 25 years, which is a nice run, but it's still merely a brand. If everybody who's currently working and networking and fighting together under that VDARE brand just reshuffles and stays in the fight in other ways, then it's not a defeat in a fundamental sense. That's what I think. Okay, so guys, let me begin with Matt. Room for improvement. Are there things in this book or arguments that I'm making that you think could be better? Or are there things that I'm just missing the boat on?
I think it's a valuable book. I think it's a necessary book. I recommend the book. That said, at times I did wonder, should this book have been titled Against Russia? And I have a more nuanced take on the Ukraine conflict. And I think that the nature of nationalism and the nature of geopolitics requires, to some degree, you put too many of your eggs, ideological eggs, in the basket of this Ukraine conflict, which is not a clean nationalism versus imperialism challenge. So I think everything you say in the book is correct in the abstract. But then I do have heartburn, and I know some of the listeners do too. And reading this book, I wanted to be entirely on the side of Ukraine pushing, you know, Russia all the way back within the context you're describing. But I don't know if that's the full context of the struggle. I would encourage people who aren't necessarily as excited about the Ukrainian side of the struggle to not give up on this book and not give up on the ideas in this book just because of that particular conflict would be my pushback.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. I really appreciate that. In the end, I do think, and I started saying this early on in the Ukraine conflict, that, and I try to persuade my Ukrainian nationalist friends of this, that they're actually better off without Crimea and without these places like the Luhansk and Donetsk. They're actually a more homogeneous society. But their response to that was very simple. They said, these are just transparently bad faith, disposable pretexts, and that the Russians just really want all of the country back. And that they can never, and because of that, they can't, I think, believe that the other side could ever negotiate in good faith and that this could ever end. And I think that that's just, I think it will end. I think there will be a negotiated settlement. I think that what will happen is eventually the Ukrainians, what will happen is basically the current lines will just become some sort of frozen conflict. There'll be a ceasefire, and who knows, in 5 years when Putin is dead, maybe it'll open up again, or maybe there'll be changes. What I would like, and really what I've wanted for as long as, you know, this war has been going on, is for there to be some kind of quick, dirty, compromise, negotiated settlement, and then maybe things can be worked out in the future when certain parties are dead and other tempers are cooled. But anyway, Pox, we're running out of time, so I have to be brief. But Pox, where do you think where's there room for improvement? Let's put it that way.
Well, as you know, we're pretty much on the same page on this issue, and I think I brought up most of the steel men that I could construct. But one final stab of the rapier could be, again, trying to be as practical and realistic as possible. If it's true that the future, the arc of history is, as you say, leaning towards separations, separatism, divorce, independence movements. And if there is evidence to suggest that that's true, if you look at Scotland or Catalonia, well, what do you practically, and as a realist, What do you have to say about the fact that so many of these independence movements are actually lousy with Antifa and globalists and leftists, and the first thing they're going to do, if and when they get their independence, is run into the arms of the EU?
Yeah, that's a good question. I actually dealt with that with a recent piece in response to a friend of mine. And it's up at Countercurrents. It's called In Defense of Ethno-Nationalism. And basically, this is my very pragmatic argument. Of course, I want an independent Catalonia to have a sensible government. I want the best for all white people. I certainly recognize that a lot of these independence movements are lousy with Marxists and globalists and ethno-nihilists and crazy people. I do think that this is a sign of political realism on the part of Marxists, that they have embraced national liberation struggles and then tried to subvert them. I wish that we would embrace national liberation struggles and instead of subverting them, actually encourage them along. That said, I think that anything that leads to the peaceful bloodless, especially we want peaceful and bloodless examples like the velvet divorce between the Czechs and the Slovaks. Anything that leads to different nations breaking away and becoming independent in a peaceful and bloodless fashion, amicable divorce, is an example that we can point to of an alternative to multiculturalism, a workable exit strategy for multiculturalism. And those are good things that we can point to. I want more examples of that. I do not want people to constantly say, oh, India and Pakistan and a million people died, etc. This is what you want. No, I want something like the velvet divorce or the velvet divorce between the various constituents of the United Kingdom someday. Something like that. These things are possible. And I would like more examples of this. The other thing is this, even though Brexit didn't really work in the sense of putting nationalists and British national interests in charge in London, because, of course, the country is lousy and rotten, especially its elites, with globalists of their own. Even though Brexit didn't work the way that nationalists would have liked it to have worked, it was still a big blow to the globalists in the EU. Why? Well, how do I know this? Because they went absolutely crazy and they're still seething about this years later. They spent enormous amounts of time and energy, psychological intensity, and vast amounts of money on trying to keep Britain within the EU. When that failed, they had to regroup and spend enormous amounts of capital of all sorts on basically gutting Brexit, slowing it down, gutting it and getting rid of all substance to it and reduplicating all the bad things that they were getting from Brussels on the local level. That cost them a lot of resources. And those resources, instead of defending globalism, instead of recouping lost ground for globalism, could have been used for pushing forward with globalism. Okay. And so I consider that a win for us. I like Guido Taglietti's book that you reviewed for Countercurrents. Mm-hmm. I like the point that you emphasized that nationalists need to stop. We need to stop thinking like Republicans. We need to stop thinking like the adults who are trying to make their system work, even though it's being run by manifestly irresponsible people, basically overgrown children and just lunatics, right? We still have this attitude that we need to make it somehow work. Republicans in America are like this. Well, let's put complete insanity and racial nihilism on sound fiscal footing. We don't want to be those people. We need to start making more problems for the system, mm-hmm. not solving the system's problems, but making more problems. We need to think, and this makes us not reactionary, but active. Mm-hmm. I almost said proactive. Anyway, we need to be active, not reactionary and passive. And secession, no matter what kind of agenda is pushing it, no matter who ends up running new states, still creates problems for the globalists. And I want to see that happen. I want to see ethno-nationalist secession movements in Europe, and I want to see more let's say, implicitly nationalist, but more explicitly ideological secession movements in the United States. In the United States, we're seeing a kind of, as I said earlier, ethnogenesis. Red and blue America are becoming different peoples. And I would like to see different states for those different peoples. And that creates problems for the globalists. And so the forces of identity and rootedness win whenever the forces of globalism and homogenization and racial nihilism are forced to slow down for a minute or recoup lost ground. Eventually, of course, we just have to defeat them outright. But one of the ways that we defeat them is just by nipping at their heels and causing them lots and lots of problems and exhausting them. It's like we should be like hyenas, you know, taking down a lion. So there you can see YouTube videos of this. It's a ghastly sight, you know, but these great noble beasts can be taken down by smaller, vicious creatures working together as a team. We need to work like that. We need to beset them from all sides with new problems, as if they didn't have enough problems to manage, namely the problems that they're creating by diversity and globalization. So that's my short answer to that. But that isn't in the book. That's something that I had to just write recently. So we are over time. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for reading the book. Thank you for sharing your thoughts on it. I want to thank everybody who's donated. I want to thank all the listeners out there. I want to thank our great moderators. We've had such a great crew tonight. You practically don't need to moderate at all. It's practically a night watchman state. Anyway, we will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. In the meantime, everybody keep reading Countercurrents, but also, how do they follow you, Matt Parrott? How do they read more of your work?
Matthew Parrott on Twitter, matthewparrott.substack.com, and also the same Matthew Parrott, that's two R's, two T's, on Telegram. Those are my three flagships, depending on my mood and the mood of the people who censor things on the internet. One of those three will always be available.
Great. Pox, Angelo, how do people follow you?
Well, they can read my stuff that is published on Countercurrents. It's also on my Substack, same name, Pax Populi. There's a handful of articles on the Substack that are only on the Substack, so people can find those there. Telegram has been my longtime stomping ground, so I'm there. And then you can also find me on Twitter at Pox's Foxes. That's P-O-X-E-S, and then the plural of foxes.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We don't have a guest lined up for next week. Maybe some of you guys would like to suggest a guest for next week, but we will definitely be back with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.